Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 18th, 1998. In the Creekside room this evening is Ana Maria Pineda. Session number is 98-4 and is titled The Celebration of Baptism in the Hispanic Community. Let's listen in.
Some of you already perhaps have met me, but let me reintroduce myself. I'm Ana Maria Pineda. I'm a sister of Lucy, Roman Catholic. I was actually born in Central America, in El Salvador. Some of you know this by memory already. And came to the States when I was 2 years old and grew up in a San Francisco neighborhood called The Mission, or La Misión. And the reason it's called La Misión is because one of the original Franciscan missions is in the area. So the entire neighborhood was referred to as La Misión. But I think I was like 21 or 22 or 23 when I figured that out. I just thought it was the name of our neighborhood, the name of the extended family that we enjoy. But actually, that's a very important part of the topic that we're going to look at this evening, which is the wonderful celebration of baptism and how in the Hispanic community it takes on particular meaning given the cultural context. Let me just begin by telling you a little story that will have connections to what I'm about to share. My mother and father, my older brother and myself, were the only ones that came originally from Central America to the States. And in the course of time, we had three more additions. Another sister, another brother, and lo and behold, like, at a time when my older brother was 17 and the youngest was 10, we had another wonderful surprise, and this is the fifth member of the family. It was my brother, correct, the youngest. But none of the other family members came up to the States. And I don't really know why, because it's very customary when some members of the family come up to the States, but generally other members of the family follow. But that was not the case. So we grew up without what people would normally consider the Latino family, with aunts and uncles and cousins or grandparents. We didn't know them, as a matter of fact, because they were in Central America and they didn't come up. And the one thing I do know is that we always had family. And my mother would say of my father, with great laughter, "Your father is incredible. He has this incredible ability to walk into a room where he absolutely knows no one. And by the time the evening is over, he'll come to me and he'll say, 'Matilde, I just met a cousin of mine.' And then there's an uncle I have, and pretty soon half of the gathering were relatives." And it was always very suspicious whether this was true, you know, in terms of blood relations. But then the house was filled with compadres and uncles and aunts and cousins. And we never quite knew where the bloodlines began and ended, or if they even existed. But that was a perfect example of an extended family in our experience, and which is very much part of the Hispanic experience. If you don't have an extended family that is of your blood, then you create one. And even if you do have one, you still create one. And this is very important in relationship to the sacrament of baptism, or the celebration of baptism. Like for all of us, life is a precious gift. Children are a very precious gift, and children are always loved and welcomed into the household, even when there may not be room for another child. You know, you think about it financially, you think about it at a certain time of your life, it's not convenient, it doesn't seem like the moment. But that, frankly, is never a big question in the Hispanic community, that children are always welcomed. And there is a custom. And what I'm telling you is all indirectly related to baptism, but in many ways related. There is a custom that many Hispanics still celebrate here in this country, perhaps more in Latin America, but where the child soon after birth is taken to church and many times even placed on the altar and offered, dedicated to God, or sometimes dedicated under special protection of a saint, that you have great devotion to. And my mother tells me that that's what they did with me when I was born. She took me to church in Central America in El Salvador and dedicated me or offered me to Mary. And this was it's a very common occurrence. And the offering is, you realize that it's a gift. This child is a gift and a blessing from God. But this child doesn't really belong to you in many ways. This child is a manifestation of the sacred. It's a gift from God. And you will take care of this child in that way, in the sense that it's a gift. But it also occurs to me that scripturally, this is not an unknown occurrence, because you find examples of this, and the one example I wanted to share is from Luke, and it's the offering of Jesus in the temple. When the time came for the purification according to the law of Moses, they brought him up to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord, as it is written in the law of the Lord, every firstborn male shall be designated as holy to the Lord. And they offered a sacrifice according to what is stated in the law of the Lord, a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons. Now there was a man in Jerusalem whose name was Simeon. This man was righteous and devout, looking forward to the consolation of Israel, and the Holy Spirit rested on him. It had been revealed to him by the Holy Spirit that he would not see death before he had seen the Lord's Messiah. Guided by the Spirit, Simeon came into the temple, and when the parents brought in the child Jesus to do for him what was customary under the law, Simeon took him in his arms and praised God. And then we have the Canticle of Simeon. So scripturally, there's a basis for customs that seem to grow out of the intuition of a people, of a culture, an intuition that tells us that this is a gift, this child is a gift from God, and we offer this child in many ways back to God. And we also ask God for protection and for guidance as the child is reared. Baptism in the Hispanic community is extremely important, not only because it's clear to us, as it's clear to many Christians, that this child is going to be welcomed into the family of God, but also because it establishes another level of relationship that's going to be very important through the inviting loved ones to become godparents to this child. But before I go into the whole concept of godparents, let me talk a little bit more about the extended family, because I think that helps us put it into context. Before the Spaniards came to the New World, the family was considered in the indigenous cultures to be very important as the basis of all society. And it was the community that really formed each individual or socialized each individual into an understanding of what it meant to be human and how you were to become a human, a person with all the qualities and values that that particular community celebrated and lived and cherished. There was a very interesting symbol that was used in the indigenous peoples, and that was the mirror. The mirror where you look at yourself in the morning and you get reflected back a reality, which is yourself. The way the indigenous peoples used it was to say that the community was the mirror. So the child would look at the community and see how the elders in that community or the other members of that community behaved. And the manner in which they behaved then told them what they were to become. And this was the way that they were taught what was important to the community. Somehow, even with the Spanish conquest, some of those qualities were never forgotten. So family is extremely important. It's the basis. And today, it continues to be important to the Hispanic community. But the familia does not just include father, mother, brother, or sister. It extends to grandparents. It extends to aunts, to uncles, to cousins. So when you say, my family, you're not just talking about what here in our society we think of as the nuclear family. We extend it beyond. And sometimes, and oftentimes, it becomes very strange when all of a sudden we claim in-laws as family members. And the lines get very blurred. I go around, I'm a sister, I'm not married, I don't have children. And I go around saying, well, my mother-in-law. And they go, well, how can you have a mother-in-law? I said, well, I do have one. I have several, as a matter of fact. My brother's mother-in-law, my sister's mother-in-law, I go through the whole list. And they go, well, that's not quite the same thing. I go, oh, yes, it is. You worry about the in-laws, you worry about your cousin-in-laws, your sister-in-laws, your brother-in-laws. They're part of the family, and there's very little distinction. And so that becomes another level of the extended family. Within the extended family, the elderly have a very privileged position, an important position, because they are the sources of wisdom, the sources of a life lived well, or at least they've struggled well, and they can teach us much of what it means to be a human being and the challenges that can face you in the course of a lifetime. Unfortunately today, you know, even those qualities are being challenged and questioned in this society, and it's very heartbreaking for any of us to, at some point in time, have to make a decision, what do you do with the elderly of your household? And it's a particular pain in the Latino community to think of placing a loved one in a home for the elderly, or it causes great consternation and suffering, because that's not what you would want to do. And in society, unfortunately, we don't have the same structures that we have in our own Latin American countries, where the neighborhood becomes part of the extended family and will care for the elderly and accompany you in all the challenges that require. But the elderly are very special to the family. And interestingly enough, another little category emerges, which is the viejitos. And what I mean by viejitos are the older people that aren't even related to you. The older people of the community, of the neighborhood, it is not an uncommon sight for you to walk into church on a Sunday for worship. And there's some viejitos in the neighborhood who don't have family. And you have members of that community come up and say, ¿Qué tal, abuela? How are you, grandma? It's not their grandmother, but it is their grandmother. Yeah, bien, hijo. Yes, my son, fine, I'm fine. Or, so these exchanges of love and concern, and it is the family. And these viejitos become part of the family, and the children greet them as their grandparents. But they're not their grandparents, but they are their grandparents. And it's that wonderful ability to keep making family, because we are actually related in more ways than we can acknowledge. There's another category of family, which are the hijos de crianza, which means sometimes children that you bring into the household that don't have parents or in abusive situations or for a number of reasons don't have parents to raise them. And probably more common than not in Latin America and here, these children become part of the family without adoption papers. That they were it was the son of your best friend, and the best friend died in an accident. So this child becomes part of the household and has equal rights to everything, like it were a son or a daughter, that was yours because of a birth, you know, birth child. And another important category or area is the deceased, those who have died. The grandparents who have died, the brothers who have died, the uncles who have died, the cousins who have died, the husbands and wives who have died. they still continue to be part of the family, because in the Hispanic understanding of life, death doesn't separate us from that reality. And so we might even continue to have conversations with those loved ones who have died, because they are still part of our family. And we look toward them in moments of need or in moments of celebration. You would like them to have been there in their physical presence, but that does not negate the fact that they're still there in spirit, and that they accompany you, and that they look out for your welfare, and that you turn to them in need, and that you talk to them and have conversations with them. So the extended family becomes greater than we can even imagine. And there's another group closely, directly related to baptism, which are the compadres in Spanish. There isn't a word equivalent in English, because in Spanish, compadres means co-parents. That's the way the word is divided. In English, we use godparents. In Spanish, it has a whole other significance. And it's the following. We know that through baptism, we are invited into the family of God, and we become members of the family of God. And in the Hispanic community, the compadres, who are going to be the padrinos, the parents, literally, of the child, have to be especially chosen. They are not chosen just because you like them, just because they're nice people, or just because they are your childhood pal. You choose them because you consider them to be the kind of people that could be the father, could be the mother of the child that you are bringing to baptism. And it's really important. And you spend a lot of time deliberating who is going to be the godparent. Because this godparent, or compadre, or padrino, is not only going to be the parent in terms of the spiritual connection, but is also going to accompany the life of the child through a lifetime. Through teenage years, through young adult years, through as long as your life permits. And so the obligations are almost the same as those of parents. And in the Latino community, the way it begins to happen is that from the beginning, you assume responsibility for the child who's going to be your godchild. So you, and the word in Spanish is ahijado, ahijado, A-H-I-J-A-D-A, which means, comes from the root word hijo, son, hija, daughter. So how do you assume some of this responsibility? In many Hispanic communities, it serves a number of purposes, but one of them is you begin even by buying or providing for them the baptismal gown, or the candle that is going to be used, or anything else, of any of the other symbols that are going to be used in the actual baptism. And this is the beginning of a very profound relationship with that family, with the parents of that family, and with the child of that family. Now, in terms of social responsibility, sometimes the experience of the compadres extends itself, if you will, to minor compadres. And it's a way of helping the family provide for the celebration of this child into their family, into the Christian community, into the neighborhood, into society. So you share the expenses so as to help the parents be able to celebrate. And it doesn't have to be an elaborate celebration, but just to help them celebrate. So you have, this is going to sound very unusual, but you can have compadres of the invitations that go out, compadres or padrinos of the little mementos that you provide. if you have a cake, someone might even be the compadre of the cake. So pretty soon you have an entire party put together, and you do it by having all these relationships that are multiplied and enhanced. And the family becomes even greater. So between the godparents, the compadres who baptize the child, and the parents of the child who are baptized, you become like blood relations. You are family. And you even take great delight in using the term compadre. So you're no longer like Ana Maria. Hi, comadre, ¿cómo estás? Hi, comadre, ¿qué tal? You know, how are you? And it's like saying, hi, brother, hi, sister, hi, bro. You know, the kids go, hi, bro. Everybody's hi, bro. So this becomes, it's just part of the family. And this child then is your responsibility. And that's why for anybody to assume to be godparents of a child, you think it over very carefully, because it means that in good times and in bad times, you are the godmother or you are the godfather, and you are there and you accompany that child. And you make sure that during this child's growing years and even into adulthood, that you are there for special moments. So you're there for their birthday. You're there for the day that their first day of school. You're there when they get in trouble. You're there when they receive other sacraments of the church. You're there for their 15th birthday. You're there when they're off to college. You're there when they get engaged. You're there when they get married. You're there when the birth of their first child comes along. And that is your relationship. I have three goddaughters. It's interesting that they're three little girls, but they're all children, daughters of my siblings. And that's a very serious relationship. So I'm always very conscious. Their birthday's coming up. This is coming up. Halloween is coming up. Christmas is coming up. And there's even though they're my siblings, my brother and my sister, there's another level of relationship that takes place. They're still my brother, they're still my sister, but there's little consultations that occur. Well, she's doing this. Isn't this funny? Or what do you think? And you should really talk to her. Yes, I should really talk. And of course, the three that I have are the three most liveliest of the bunch. So I get to have lots of little conversations with
her. Can you decline?
Oh, yes.
And ask her, how does that work? How do you do that?
Well, you probably would have to find a way of declining, but you really would need to know how much responsibility you can take on. And I think people do. I know of a case where my brother and my sister-in-law were asked to be godparents, and they really thought it over and said, you know, we really can't assume this responsibility for this child, or the relationship with their parents is not as strong as we would like it to be. So it wouldn't be honest, and it wouldn't be fair to the child or to the to the parents. And so they declined to do that. So there is that kind of a weight to it.
Can I ask you something?
Please.
Is there kind of like a limit to how many that a person can have, or you take as many as you
The limit is what you quite honestly can accompany. I mean, it's like parenting. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, I'm not going to say that every single person that assumes to be godparents of a child in the Hispanic community sees the responsibility through. But in the Latino community, you know that you really have to think it through, and that there are consequences to accepting this invitation. And I think what also happens is that sometimes it can be within the family itself, where you ask members of the family to assume this relationship, but you also ask outside of the family, but they have to be friends that are very close friends, that you're in close contact with, that you are assured in one way or another are going to be part of the family. And then, interestingly enough, you may be adopted to be a godmother. Like you weren't the one that accompanied the child to their baptism, but you get adopted. Like some of my own nieces or nephews, for one reason or another, their godparents hasn't been as active. So all of a sudden, I'm the Nina. Nina is like a short term for madrina, which means godmother. I said, "Oh, hi, Nina." And then the real, you know, I have to say, "Hey, wait a minute, she's my Nina, she's not yours." But there is that relationship that does build up. So I could talk on, more, but that's not necessary. I think I'd like to open it up, you know, for conversation or for exchange. I think that the focus of even this sharing is that it's a practice, it's a lifetime practice of how to assume the responsibility of being a godparent. It's not just for the moment, it's for a lifetime. And this practice of being in this particular relationship also is a formational relationship for the children that are placed in your responsibility. And if it's not practiced in this particular way in different cultural contexts, it might be of interest for all of us to think about how do we provide for the accompanying of our own children, you know, in your situations, in a life of faith, or in something that should be so central to the Christian mystery or to the Christian community. How do we find ways of supporting their growth and their maturing in the faith? And people who can accompany them in that? Or do we need to reconsider how the role of godparents is celebrated and used within the Christian community? So I will open it up for conversation or for thoughts on the topic that we're thinking about today.
I'm intrigued as I listen about what appears to be a coming together of both the indigenous and the religious, which in this case would be the Catholic tradition, mm-hmm. even though in many ways that was a very negative thing, so that it survived or was enhanced, or what would you say about that? Apart from the church, there was this indigenous extended family, village concept.
Yes.
Was it integrated in the church? Did it survive as part of the church? Was it enhanced by the church? It hadn't occurred to me how the two came together, and it's very much practiced as a Latino, predominantly Catholic, although presumably it survives in the Protestant tradition in Latin America as well.
I think it does. The pastoral issues that sometimes come up is that in church settings, the role of the padrino is not always fully understood by a parish. And so in many parishes today, at least in the Roman Catholic tradition, I don't know, I imagine it's the same in others, you have a period of preparation so that the godparents know what their responsibilities are in regard to the faith. But sometimes in some parishes, they don't understand why parents will say, "Well, we don't want to baptize a child quite yet because the godparents can't come. They're like in Mexico. And so can we wait?" And they'll go, "Well, they have to go through this series of sessions to be prepared." And they said, "Yes, but, you know, the godparents can't come when you're scheduling the baptism." And so there's some pastoral difficulty, because what is not understood is that the godparents that are being chosen are very essential to that baptismal celebration. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, sometimes the church can actually become an obstacle for the celebration and for the extension of the family in ways that are important to this community. The other thing that is particular in some, not only Latino, but I know like Filipino communities, is that you might end up having a double set of godparents. So that you don't only have one set, but you have two sets. And then pastorally, the question comes up, well, won't one be enough? Well, for some reason, it seems important to have two sets. And the family has thought it through. And they think that for this child, probably two sets might be required. In more serious vein, there are reasons why the family is asking for this. So, and in the non-Hispanic world, I think the idea of the extended family is not totally understood. Like they'll say, well, for this, we have so many children coming to receive Eucharist for the first time or being baptized, that we have to limit the number of participants. So you can only have four tickets or something.
Yeah.
And they go, well, what about the grandparents? Well, I mean, the grandparents are essential. Yes, they are. And their cousins are too. And then, you know, so in spite of sometimes, it continues. And in some cases, the church communities are very responsible and very agreeable to doing it in that manner.
But what you're saying, it also strikes me as happening a lot in Southern Africa, having some background in the church in Southern Africa, that it seems really similar. And I'm wondering if it might not be European culture that has somehow lost that, what I feel is the original vision of baptism and bringing people into a community.
You mean the pastoral difficulties?
Not the pastoral difficulties, but the misunderstanding of what baptism is, which I understand in this country predominantly is reduced to you bring in your baby, the baby done, so that the baby goes to heaven after it dies, rather than the notion that you bring this child into the community of faith and is nurtured along the way. And I'm wondering if that's just part of our culture that we've lost. I
think it's true, because I've run into people that really yearn to know what it means to be a godparent. When I worked in Minneapolis, a small bookstore, and in our bookstore here, people come in all the time and say, do you have some resources on how to be a godparent? Or my godchild, I need a gift for, how do I respond to or support? I think there's a yearning amongst certain people, people that hang around places like Golden Village, to know, to regain that.
Well, there's, I think, a great yearning and longing in all of us to belong, and to belong to a community that can nourish us and support us and accompany us. And in our society, in many ways, it's very alienating. Yeah, there are many people that loneliness is the worst possible enemy, and the worst reality.
In the baptism,
I was just going to say, one of the little things that I see that relates to that, I've been a purchaser of greeting cards for the last 10 years for small places, including Holden. And up until just a few years ago, I was able to find, not able to find, baptismal birthday cards. And now, a few years ago, I was able to find one amongst a number of small places. And now, this last year, I found a couple more, and a set of, for the first 12 years. So that people are starting to think there's a market out there, for one thing. But it's also satisfying a desire.
The baptismal levels that the parents take, and that the should godparents or sponsors be chosen, there's a part that says that you will be responsible for putting the scriptures in their hands and for seeing that their growth occurs in religious matters. But I don't think our culture understands what that truly means.
And I think it's not even, perhaps we think of it in very legalistic ways. Like, unless you sit down and teach your child Bible stories or teach your child things of faith, that you're not, that's the only way to fulfill the godparent world, and it's not. It's really wonderful. You go to their soccer games, and you're there when they bring an all-age report card. You know, that could happen very often, right? But it's all those very, their birthdays, it's all those very important moments where you somehow make yourself available and present to them, so that there's a relationship that is developed. And there's great love. I mean, it's a very loving relationship. But not only loving, there's a lot of responsibility. One day my niece, my oldest niece, who's my first goddaughter, and she makes a big point of saying that to the other two. Mm-hmm. I was the first one. I said, okay, she's the first one. We just baptized the youngest child, who is 5 months old. Her name is Galina. And this child is a miracle child, because she almost died the day after she was born. And the God, my brother and sister-in-law decided and thought about who was going to be the godmother, and they chose me to be the godmother, which I consider to be a wonderful joy and privilege. But when this child was baptized, the day she was baptized, the other two goddaughters that I have, of course, are in the family, and they were there. And the two of them were eyeing this child, and the oldest one comes over and says, you know, I was the first one. And the other one says, yes, and I was the second. So this is quite interesting. I said, yes, and this is also part of the family, the child. But the oldest one, when they said to my brother, okay, Dad, explain this to me. Anna is my godmother. So what happens, like, if there's an accident or something and you and Mom die, does that mean that she'll be responsible for me? It's really, it was very interesting, very telling question. And my brother goes, heavy and high. Well, the fact of the matter is that in some ways, maybe I couldn't do it financially because of my own state of life, in my own, you know, calling, but I would have serious responsibilities with that child more than I even have now, if that were to happen. And I think she realized that. She realized it even more than my brother did. She's asking those questions. Mm-hmm. So it's carried. It can be carried to the ultimate consequences.
It must bring her some comfort, too, to know that should her parents die, she still has an adult that she has established a wonderful familial relationship with as a co-parent, mm-hmm. that will carry on, whether it is under her own roof or not, you are still there.
And you look after that child.
Yeah. That must be a wonderful comfort. Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful joy. Yeah. I really love it. It's marvelous.
So cool.
In the South, it's interesting that in South Carolina and in the African American community, friends of mine will say, this is my godchild, and I'll stop because I know they're African Methodist Episcopalian, or some church doesn't have infant baptism. They won't have baptism until these are teenagers or adults. But they are selected in the same way, with that same importance, as part of the extended family, even though it's not connected to a religious sacrament. Mm-hmm.
If you're not blood related, you do, because they become part of all the family gatherings, so the celebrations and the funerals as well, and, you know, the moments of grieving and loss as well.
One of my favorite stories is a close friend of ours. We never ask Betty how she is. We say, how many children do you have now? Because she just, you know, keeps taking children. And she was dating this man, and he was coming for Thanksgiving. So I asked her the day afterwards, how did Thanksgiving go? He was like, you know, who knew how many people they were going to have there? And she said, well, we had, you know, I think it was like 30-some people. And I said, well, you know, how did Charlie do? And she said, well, let's put it this way. Because he was the only non-member of this. You know, and she says, it was kind of like a white person being there with our family. And I immediately know what she found in terms that he was separate, because he hadn't become a part of that gathering yet.
Any other thoughts or questions or comments?
Yeah. As I say, sometimes it's interesting, as one who's worked in nursing home ministries, to see how various communities and groups, how they treat the most elderly, many times has a telltale on how these kind of relationships exist in on down the line in the other age groups, all the way down to the babies. And I've really only seen, of the Northern European groups, one that stands out in my mind as doing an excellent job, and it's a small country that most people don't give thought to, a country of Iceland. And when they establish a home for the aged, they do some very intentional things to make that home not shunted off from the rest of the community, but invariably, if it's a small rural community, it becomes in and of itself like the village center. Mm-hmm. And people stop in there for 3 o'clock coffee. Mm-hmm. And the Cub Scout and the Brownie Troop, you know, meets there. And it's kind of like you had mentioned with all of the extended grandmas and grandpas. And, mm-hmm. and when the store failed in the community and they, you know, couldn't keep a store anymore, they put a few aisles in the nursing home. So people had to come, you know, to this center. And the older ones who, you know, in the congregational life of this extended parish, you know, they were included. To the fact that they're the day before Christmas Eve, they celebrate what's a little Christmas Eve, mm-hmm. and it's at the nursing home. Mm-hmm. And that's the largest attended. The year I was the interim pastor for that, 300 people. Mm-hmm. There are 150 people in the town, but the whole surrounding mm-hmm. townships, everybody came, and it was an honor and a tribute to look in on this extended family, which they did a pretty good job of during the year anyway, but especially at a holy day or, you know, occasionally. That's about the only good, healthy, strong, you know, that I've seen, you know, that would come anywhere close to that, where even though it wasn't your grandmother, she was interested in what you were doing.
I think in when we think about baptism and coming into the family of God, it's in the broadest sense of the word. So in some way, we are all very related. And so there should be this great sense of extended family. Because in the Latino community, and I'm not saying it's perfect, I'm just sharing with you some of the customs.
The opportunities are...
Members who aren't even Hispanic can become part of the extended family. It's incredible. Oh, this is my... Oh, I have to tell you this. This is interesting little story. Although we were all related, my father had a stroke. He died 7 years ago, but prior to that, he'd had a stroke. So the doctors did not think he was going to live beyond the stroke, and there was great debate over whether he should have surgery. The morning of the surgery, they decided he shouldn't have it because it was taking too much of a chance. And he lived 20 years beyond that. But in the process of that, he saw all of us, respond to our calling. And the youngest was the one that he wanted. That was the last one to be buried. So he was happy when that took place. And I think only after that, about a year later, my father died. But in the years closer to his death, his health wasn't always very, very strong, so he would have to go to the doctor, and it got increasingly worse. So he kept going to the doctor more and more. So we all had to take turns taking him to the doctor. So the first time we went, I went, my brother went. My brother and I looked like my father, so we're darker in coloring. But my mother is very fair. She almost looks Italian. So there are other members of the family that take after her. So we go to the doctors, and my father says, "Well, doctor, this is my daughter, and this is my son, and this is my wife." So the doctor said, "Oh, very nice to meet you." So 3 weeks later, after that, he had one of the doctors again. And this time I couldn't go. My brother couldn't go. My brother could go, who looks like my mother. So he goes, "Doctor, this is my son, Ernie." Doctor said, "Well, very nice to meet you." He's looking at my brother, who was Italian. Okay. So a couple of months go by, and none of us could go, of my siblings. But my brother-in-law was available, and he's Japanese. So they go to the doctor, and then my father says, "Doctor, I want to introduce you to my son. This is my son, Neil." How is this possible? But it's that sense, you know, the in-laws obviously are part, but then you have members who aren't even blood related in any way. They're not Hispanic, they're not Latinos, But they become part of the family because they're loved and, you know, they're welcome into the family.
You never, the doctor never told us the mystery of why he was struck by the third introduction.
I wanted to say something about, to me, the idea of compadrismo, which is the co-parenthood, it really shows that it takes more than one person, it takes a village to raise a child, and that child is a child of God, it's only yours for a little while. We can only do some, you know, gifting in terms of your knowledge, and then you have to ask other members of the community to endow that child with wisdom and knowledge and opportunities and experiences. And that's what the compadrismo means to us. Like, and also an opportunity to be closer to people who you relate to maybe in a spiritually or a mental way more than you do in a blood relation way. Mm-hmm. Because like you're talking about your family being so different, the same happened with my family. I have a sister who's married to an Italian and a brother who's married to a Chinese woman. And all my nephews and nieces are totally different from my own kids. They don't look like they're related at all. You know, I have a half Chinese niece and, you know, half Italian, two half Italian nephews. So, you know, compadrismo is like that glue that keeps us together and also makes our family bigger. Instead of smaller.
And the way you've said it is very apt. It takes more than just a nuclear family, if you will, to raise a child.
And when Tom brought this thing about South Africa, you know, that's the same place in Indonesia, in Philippines, I mean, in Japan, every place where we've lived, and other people have lived and told us, the family is the central unit, and that child has a large extended family. Mm-hmm. Only in industrialized world, the family has become so nuclear. And the child has lost a sense of connection.
A little of that happens here in the winter when we are 60 people or so, and about 15 are children of that 60. And one time I get very used to telling the young children, don't do this, or praising them, or, you know, doing things. And one time there was a little girl in the village who was just there for a few days. And she was doing something that looked sort of dangerous to me, so I went over to her and told her to do it a different way. And she just ran away to her mother. She wasn't used to being reprimanded or spoken sternly with, or directly, by a non-parent of hers. And it was, you know, I kind of chuckled about it, because I was so used to kind of taking charge of whoever was there, keeping up.
Parenting in the absence of the parent.
Yeah.
And I think that's what should be the more healthy and wholesome relationship. Like, I certainly would hope that my neighbors or people that I don't really know well, if they see one of my children doing something wrong, that please correct them. You know, because I'm not there all the time. I cannot see it. And none of us can. And we just have to hope that the community has an access to steer them in the right direction.
It doesn't drop.
Who
are you to talk to my kid that way?
Yeah, I'm an adult and I should be respected.
Carmen, I'd like to extend it. When you commented about the appreciation for the deceased, I was reminded of a kind of dilemma in that I affirm and enjoy contemporary expressions in the liturgy, but I've always felt like we lost something very significant in the Lutheran liturgy. When the new translation of the Sursum Corda dropped the idea of angels and archangels and all the company of heaven, we laud and magnify thy holy name. You know, all the company of heaven includes that group that you're talking about.
I was going to say that too, that to my children, their grandparents that are deceased and great-great-grandparents, they all are angels. They all are guardian angels. And my 9-year-old the other day, he remembered, you know, his grandparents had passed away and he cried. And he was very emotional about it. And then he consoled himself and he said, well, listen, remember they're all angels, they're all looking after you. And then he kind of was able to go to sleep.
But this was just a couple of days ago.
This was a couple of days
ago. It was a very serious kind of remembrance. But it was very lovely because he said, we were sitting there in the living room and he said, Mama, you know something? The the thing that was great about Nanda is she kept the family together. And I remember it was so much fun going to the house and having like Sunday together. I think it was.
Well, every Sunday our family would go to the grandmother's house and then we'd run into cousins that we hadn't seen. And some of the cousins would be bringing their newborn babies or children for Nana to see and to bless and to get to know. And then that was one way he kept up with his cousins. And then when Nana passed away 4 years ago, she would have been 100 this August. And we're having a family reunion for her when we go back for a moment. But anyway, when she passed away, then you know they sold the house that was Nana's house. The cousins didn't get together anymore, and he misses that connection. And we never even had spoken about it until we were in a conversation, and he just kind of darted into our conversation and said that. And then the other thing I was going to say, when we had staff meetings, and then the pastor always comes up and says that holding is a place where a lot of people have some emotional time dealing with whatever they bring. You know, I was going to say it's not only adults, it's children. Mm-hmm. My son really had one of these, emotional rendering, remembering his grandparents, and then, you know, the idea of angels and archangels, you know, and how they're always there protecting them. And then he asked me, what's so funny? He says, well, how can he be protecting me in Arizona and my cousin in Portland? And I said, well, I don't know. Oh, I know, Mom. They got computers and video cameras. How the angels in heaven are just checking everybody out. Oh, you know, that was so adorable.
And you said,
that's exactly
they got technology.
Oh, I agree, I love it. But I think, you know, it takes a lot of creativity in our day and age to find ways of being related, to belong to a larger family. Because when you think about it, it does have, in the Latino community, a lot of spiritual values. But it also fundamentally has a real human need, which is to belong and to be protected by those with whom you belong. I mean, it's, as much as it's spiritual, you're also looking out for the welfare and somehow the protection of the family unit or the family, you know, the communal setting. So that's why godparents are also important. And very often what you do is you choose godparents that somehow can provide you with an additional amount of support. I think for poor families, it's people who are a little financially more comfortable. So there is a spiritual thing that functions and it's important, but there's also just the basic human need of belonging.
In our own congregation, which is actually quite large, about 2,500 members, when a child is baptized, there are godparents that are chosen by the family, but then there's also someone from the congregation who is chosen to be a congregational godparent, recognizing that many times familial godparents don't live right there, and wanting also to bring this child into the life of the congregation as we experience that community. Mm-hmm. And that's very recent, but I find it very appropriate and very moving.
And very important for us to find these ways.
There's some congregations to it. Have more rituals and celebrations between baptism and confirmation to help with that. For example, the presentation of the Bible, maybe at a little earlier age. The Lutheran Church has only been the last 25 years of separating First Communion from confirmation.
Yes.
And that was difficult in a lot of communities. And when they start Sunday school at age 3, in many congregations, you know, they have rituals. To recall and call people back to the promises that they made at the font. And if at all possible, they have godparents there, but to include a representative of the congregation would be good too. Especially in this day and age, like we live in a community where people only move there to get their foot into owning a house, but if they want to climb the ladder, you know, on the next nicer house, they leave the community. So they're there 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, you know, the starter home community. And, you know, somehow, at least while they're there, to have a congregational representative, people are so mobile.
So we live in a very mobile society, and that's what makes it more challenging. You know, how do we do these kinds of things?
In South America and third world countries, are the baptisms still done in the context of the worship of the community? Or are they done? I know a lot of Roman Catholic priests lament, especially my dear colleagues at Transfiguration, where you might say, we lament that they have to do the baptisms after the regular community liturgy. And you know, because it takes away the sense of the community when you do it separate and just do five families.
My experience is it's done both ways. In the Hispanic parishes, baptisms go on constantly. So, like, it isn't quite the same in other neighborhoods. You know, other parish neighborhoods, but in the Hispanic parishes, they have an incredible number of baptisms going on. So sometimes they set aside like Saturday afternoon or Saturday morning, and they have a large number of children being baptized all at the same time with family and other invited relatives and so forth. So it's like it's a smaller community than you would like in a Sunday worship, but it does in fact in many ways have the same symbolism. I don't know of many baptisms that take place individually as much anymore, unless the parishes where the children, the number of baptisms are much smaller, that might occur, and then they occur within the celebration of worship itself. But I couldn't tell you that it's even across the board, because from place to place, there's slightly different practices, and you know, people do it in slightly different ways. And I have students visit some of the Hispanic parishes, and they're always like astonished. We went, it was just a Saturday, and there are like 20 families. I said, yes, imagine, that's one Saturday. And yes, just think if you were trying to do this, like, you know, doing one Sunday a month, there'd be a lot of children. Any other comments or remarks? Well, thank you for coming on a late Saturday afternoon. after a very nice dinner this evening, which brings us into sleepier times here. But perhaps it would just invite you to continue reflecting on, you know, how we provide for the young of our families and the Christian community, and how we understand that and how we extend it and support it and make it possible. And in our day and age, with the number of challenges that we have on all fronts, I think it's even more necessary. And I just provided this visual symbols because in baptism we use the water, the light is always part of it, and of course the oil, which I don't have, the Word of God. And it's a celebration of bringing children into the community, but also into our families and into our societies. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.